Duff left the marshal's office, then walked over to the Fiddler's Green. He walked over to a table where a group of men were sitting, including Fred Matthews, the owner of the Chugwater Mercantile, Charlie Blanton, owner and publisher of the Defender, and Elmer, who'd gone straight to the Fiddler's Green as soon as he and Duff had reached town. The saloon owner, Biff Johnson, was sitting with him as well. Biff Johnson was a former first sergeant in the Army, and he'd been in the 7th Cavalry with Reno at the Battle of Little Bighorn. He had named his saloon Fiddler's Green after the old cavalry legend that any troop who had ever heard the trumpeter play Boots and Saddles will, when he has died, go to Fiddler's Green, there to drink and visit with all the other cavalrymen until final judgment. Elmer had already shared with them the story of Duff's encounter with the three men on the road, and Blanton was busy writing the story.
Did you get the telegram sent?
Aye. I told Chief Davis what happened and where to find the bodies. Then I stopped down to the constable's office and told Marshal Farrell. I also told him I'd be available if either he or Chief Davis needs me.
They aren't going to need you.
Murchison came into the saloon then, carrying a telegram with him.
Chief Davis just sent this telegram to you and to Marshal Farrell.
Duff read the telegram out loud.
The bodies of Dingus Camden, Lee and Marvin Mosley have already been recovered. The incident was witnessed by Mr. Evan Webb. His story corroborates the account told by Mr. McAllister. No further investigation is needed. Good. Thank you, Mr. Murchison.
Sure thing.
Tis glad I am to be done with that adventure.
You weren't the only one with an adventure. Elmer here had an adventure of his own.
Oh, it wasn't much of an adventure.
Hell, it wasn't. Folks in here are still talking about it.
What happened?
Biff told the others the story of how Elmer had backed down a young would-be gunman named Cleet Wilson.
Have you seen him since then?
Ain't seen hide nor hair of him. If you want my thinking, it's that he's plumb out of the territory now.
The conversation returned to Duff's intention to stock his ranch with Black Angus.
Well, I still don't understand why you gotta go to all the trouble to get Black Angus cows. Longhorns have been just fine for as long as I can remember.
Well, Fred, if Sky Meadow is to prosper, it will have to stand out among all the other fine ranches in Chugwater Valley. And there's no better way for me to do that than to be stuck in my ranch with the best beef cattle in the world. And that would be Black Angus.
There's not a thing wrong with longhorns. They're hardy creatures, and they can live on dew and scrub grass. You go bringing in some high-toned cow, oh, it's gonna be nothing but trouble, I tell you.
Fred, have you ever eaten an Angus steak?
And how would I have done that, I ask you, when I never even heard of the creatures until Duff came up with this wild idea of his?
Well, I have. 2 years ago, my wife and I took a trip back to Scotland to see her sister, who still lives there. She served steak. And when I took my first bite, I knew it was something different. Not tough like longhorn. And never have I put a thing in my mouth that tasted better. I say go for it, Duff. And when you take your first beef to market, I'll buy a couple myself and add some fine dining by serving my customers Angus steak.
Fine dining in a saloon?
I'll build on the side. I own the empty lot next door. I'll have a saloon in here and a fine restaurant next door.
When will you actually get your cattle?
I don't know. I guess as soon as they get enough to put together to make up the herd I want.
Will they be shipping them to you, or will you have to go after them?
Mr. Khan is the Kansas City Cattle Exchange representative in Cheyenne, and I asked him to arrange for them to be shipped by train to Cheyenne. I'll drive them down from there.
500 cows, you say?
Aye.
That's a lot of cattle for one man to be driving.
I'll not be alone.
Well, is Elmer going with you?
You're damn right I'm going. I worked side by side with Duff for a year to get this ranch ready. Now that we're finally about to get some cows, I intend to be there from the beginning.
Still, 500 cows? Even with two men, that will be difficult.
I'll hire some men before then. I get the herd onto my ranch. I shall be needing a few more employees anyway.
Well, if you have any trouble coming up with hands, let me know. I can probably find a few for you.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I reckon you'll be going to the big shindig we got coming up Saturday night, won't you?
Aye. I would not wish to miss it.
Oh, you better watch it, Duff. Fred is about to try and sell you a ticket. He's the head of the Fireman's Ball Committee, so he's after every dollar he can get.
Now, it'll cost you a dollar, and if you pay now, you won't have to pay at the door. And we're going to charge a dollar and a quarter at the door.
See what I mean?
Duff pulled out his billfold and gave Fred a dollar.
Tell me, has Miss Parker bought a ticket yet?
Nope.
Duff handed Fred another dollar.
Then I should like to buy one for her.
Well now, I'm sure she'll appreciate that.
When Megan Parker was 12 years old, both of her parents were killed in a riverboat accident. She could still remember the pain and sorrow of their loss, and the fear, the absolute mind-numbing fear of what would happen to her. She needn't have worried, because even though her grandmother was already very old, she had stepped in and raised Megan as if she were her own. It had been a wonderful relationship between Megan and her grandmother, and when her grandmother died, 3 days after Megan's 19th birthday, the pain and sorrow was as great as it had been when her own parents had died. Megan was in college at the time, and although losing her grandmother was a terrible emotional blow to her, it wasn't a financial blow, because she still had the money that had been left to her by her parents. And by selling her grandmother's house, she had been able to add to her coffer. As a result, she was able to finish her education without experiencing any financial burden at all. She'd gone to college to be a school teacher, but her grandmother, a seamstress, taught Megan how to design, cut cloth, and sew women's clothes. It was a skill that Megan picked up easily, and one that she enjoyed. What Megan especially enjoyed was creating original dresses and gowns. She had a great deal of talent for it, and as it turned out, that advice may have been the most valuable thing Megan Parker's grandmother had left her. Because though she had come to Chugwater to be a school teacher, she learned when she arrived that another woman had already been hired. She was just about to return to St. Louis when she was given the opportunity to buy a dress shop, and she'd had just enough money left over to do that. That she had been successful in the enterprise was evidenced by the fact that her shop was now one of the most profitable business establishments in all of Chugwater. Megan had never been married, nor had she ever been serious about anyone before. And the question she asked herself now was, did she have a serious relationship with Duff McAllister? She couldn't answer that question. She did have a proprietary relationship with him, though, ever since she had saved his life in the gun battle that had taken place right here in Chugwater, on the street in front of her store. The gun battle had been between Duff and 8 men, which certainly meant that the odds against him were almost insurmountable. Megan had been an unintended witness to the battle from the window of her shop. Seeing quickly what was going on and understanding the odds against him, she was unwilling to stand by and watch the handsome Scotman, who she barely knew at the time, be killed. She made up her mind right there to help him any way she could. Putting down the bolt of cloth she was examining, she stepped out front. Duff McAllister's visit wasn't entirely unexpected, but seeing him come into her shop did bring a broad smile.
I saw you and Elmer ride into town earlier. I was hoping you would stop by to see me.
Sure now, lassie. And you didn't think I'd be leaving without me stopping by to tell you goodbye now.
'Twas hoping I was that you would nae be for taking your leave without so much as a visit.
Och, 'tis fun of me you'll be making.
I'm having a bit of fun, but I'm not making fun of you, Duff Tavish McAllister. Have you had your supper?
I have not.
I have some fried chicken and potato salad in the back room if you would care to join me.
I would be delighted.
They ate their meal on the same table Megan used to lay out her material when she was cutting up cloth for her sewing projects. She had made lemonade to have with her supper, and Duff was on his second glass when Megan cleared away the residue of the meal, then returned to sit across the table from him.
Tell me about her.
I beg your pardon?
Tell me about the woman back in Scotland. You never speak of her, but sometimes when you let your guard down, your eyes let me see all the way into your soul. It is a good soul, Duff Tavish McAllister. But when I look that deep, I can see the scars and the pain. Tell me about her, Duff. I want to know.
Duff looked down at his hands.
I'm sorry, Duff. Please forgive me for asking. I had no right to pry into your affairs. If you would rather not talk about it...
What can I say about Skye, Megan? Would that I were a poet, that I could express myself in words that speak of a mist on the moors, of heather and cool lakes, and all that is beautiful about Scotland and she who was my love. I would do so that others might know her as I knew her.
Your words are eloquent enough for any poet, Duff.
When she was murdered by Sheriff Somerled and his deputies, the selfsame devils who came to America to try and kill me, I thought my world had come to an end.
Oh, Duff, I'm so sorry. Please, forgive me for causing you to have to recall such painful memories.
There is nothing to forgive. The memory of her dying is painful. That is true enough. But the memories of Skye can never be painful. They can only be sweet.
How lucky she was to have known your love.
Not luck, I fear, but misfortune. For 'twas my love that got her killed.
Better to have loved and died than never to have known love at all.
For her sake, I pray that is true.
It is true, Duff. Believe me, it is true.
Megan, I...
Mr. McAllister? Mr. McAllister, are you in there?
It sounds like young Lonnie Mathers. I wonder what he wants.
Lonnie Mathers was the 17-year-old son of a widowed mother, and for the last 4 years he had taken every odd job in town to help his mother meet expenses. Most of the time, he worked for Fred Matthews in his mercantile, but he had also done jobs for R.W. Guthrie at his lumber shed, and he had even driven a freight wagon for him a few times.
There is only one way to find out.
Sorry to be bothering you, Mr. McAllister, but the fellers down at Fiddler's Green said you'd be here, and Mr. Murchison at the telegraph office said that more than likely you'd be wanting to see this here telegraph right away.
Thank you, Lonnie.
Duff handed the boy half a dollar.
Dang! Thank you!
I don't like telegrams. Too often they bring bad news.
They're used for things other than bad news.
Pulling out the little yellow piece of paper, Duff read it. Then he frowned.
You're frowning. Is it something bad?
No, not really.
Not really? That means it's a little bad, doesn't it?
It's a telegram from the Kansas City Cattle Exchange.
Isn't that where you're going to buy your cattle?
Aye. They've received my order, and they're putting together a herd for me. But in order to ship the cattle, I'm going to have to go there to make arrangements. It says they've mailed a letter with all the details.
That means you're going to have to go to Kansas City?
I'm afraid so.
When will you go?
I don't know yet. Probably sometime next week.
Oh, so you will be here for the Fireman's Benefit Ball?
Aye, lass, I'd not be for missing that.
Good. I'll be there too.
And would you be for dancing with an awkward Scot such as myself?
Nothing would please me more.
Good. Being Scot as I am, I would not like to think I bought your ticket for naught.
You bought my ticket?
Aye, that I have done. I was about to tell you that when the young lad banged so loudly upon the door.
Why, Duff McAllister, how nice of you.
I've been known from time to time to do nice things.
Oh, of that I have no doubt. But now, I've something to ask you, and I hope the question doesn't make you uncomfortable.
Lass, I hardly think you can ask a question that would make me uncomfortable.
In the letter that you had Elmer deliver to me, there was a paragraph that I found confusing. I was hoping that perhaps you could clear it up for me.
What was the paragraph?
Megan walked over to the sideboard to pick up the letter.
While in Cheyenne, I intend to make arrangements to bring cattle onto my land so that After a year of preparation, Sky Meadow will truly become a cattle ranch. I am sure that the news of my establishing a ranch is important to you only as a matter of the friendship that exists between the two of us. However, and this is the part that I wanted to ask you about, there may come a time when this information would be of much greater interest to you.
Megan folded the letter and returned it to the envelope.
Fire! Fire! Don't burn so fire! Everyone turn out!
Oh, no!
Both Duff and Megan went outside to join the others of the town as everyone hurried down to the hardware store, where flames were already leaping up through the roof. Even with all the men of the town forming a bucket brigade to keep the pumper filled, it still took 2 hours for the fire to be extinguished. And everyone agreed that if the fire department had a second pumper, the fire would have been put out much quicker.
Now, folks, this is as good a reason as I can think of for buying a ticket and coming to the fireman's ball this Saturday.
Look at Fred. No wonder he does so well with his mercantile store. The man is a born salesman.
Duff looked around and saw Megan standing on the boardwalk in front of Dunnigan's Dry Goods. She and several other women had made lemonade, and they were passing it out to the exhausted and thirsty men who had fought the fire. Duff walked over to join her, and smiling, she handed him a glass.
We didn't do much for Mr. Schoenberg's place, I'm afraid. But at least we kept the fire from spreading.
You look like a possum with all the black around your eyes.
Megan used a damp cloth to wipe his face.
Thank you. Oh, you were going to ask me a question.
I was, wasn't I? Well, never mind. I've forgotten what it is now. You must be exhausted. You need to get home and get some rest. I'll see you at the dance Saturday night.
Hodge Denman found himself squinting into the low light of the Bucket of Blood saloon. He was looking around the room to see if he could find anyone who fit Kingsley's description. Denman was a small man with delicate feminine features, and his hair was blonde and thin, of a color and texture that made it look almost as if he were bald until one got closer to him. Anyone could look at him and know immediately that he was very much out of his element in a place like the Bucket of Blood Saloon. To his frustration and no small amount of worry and fear, he didn't see anyone who looked anything like the description Howard had given him of Kingsley. There were a lot of ugly men and even uglier women, but he did not see anyone that he thought might be Crack Kingsley. Aggravated that Kingsley had not gotten here when he was supposed to, Denman chose a table in the back corner of the room. Nervously, Denman checked his pocket watch as well as the clock that stood against the wall of the saloon. Kingsley was already 15 minutes late. Denman would give him 15 minutes more. Only if he didn't show up by then, he'd leave.
Well, now, looky here. Aren't you a cutie, though?
One of the bar girls came up to him and began running one of her hands through his thinning hair. She was wearing a very low-cut dress, and as she leaned against him, one of her breasts threatened to spill out. She might have been pretty at one time, but the dissipation of her trade had taken its toll. Her eyes were hard, her face drawn and haggard beyond her years. She had a three-corner scar on her chin, and two of her teeth were missing.
Please, I am waiting for someone.
Well, honey, wouldn't you like to have a good time while you're waiting?
She threw one leg over his right leg, then straddled his thigh and scooted up against him, pressing against him.
Mandy can show you a real good time.
No, please, I'm not the kind who indulges in such behavior.
Would you be Denman?
I beg your pardon?
I was told to look for a scared-looking little shit. And that would be you, wouldn't it? Are you Denman?
The speaker was an ugly man with a gaunt face and a long, disfiguring scar. It had to be Kingsley.
please don't say my name so loud. I have no wish to be known by anyone who would habituate such a place as this. You would be Mr. Kingsley?
Mr. Kingsley? Yeah, I reckon that would be me.
You are late.
Well, if I've interrupted something you got going on, I reckon I can wait until you're finished.
No, I have nothing going on. I want to get our business taken care of and then leave this horrid place.
Oh, honey, you aren't in that big of a hurry, are you?
Get off in his lap, girl. You've already seen that he ain't got nothing for you.
With a pout, Mandy got off Denman's leg and then turned toward Kingsley.
Oh, how about you, honey? Have you got something for me?
Not now. Get.
Mandy walked away, rejected and angry.
Too bad I broke that up, Denman. I think Mandy was beginning to take a shine to you. And you ought to feel good about that. It takes a heap to get a whore to actually wanting you.
Please, I'm not interested in anything a prostitute might want or not want. And I don't like this place. I want to conclude our business, then leave.
Get up. I'll be taking your chair.
I beg your pardon?
I don't sit with my back to the room. Get up. I want that chair.
Oh, yes. All right. Of course.
I'll have a whiskey.
Whiskey. Yes, of course. I'll be right back.
Denman walked over to the bar, coming back a moment later with a whiskey for Kingsley.
All right, what's our business?
Is it true that you are, I don't know how to say this without coming right out and saying it, but are you really an outlaw?
Why don't you come right out and say it? You got somebody you want me to kill. Is that it?
What? Heavens, no. That's not it at all. What would make you think such a thing?
What would make me think such a thing? Well, Denman, look at you and look at me. People like me and you don't never get together unless one has something the other wants. I figure you got somebody that you think needs killing, and you're wanting me to do it for you.
Do you mean to tell me that if I did have someone for you to kill, that you would actually be willing to do something like that?
It depends on how much you'd be willing to pay. It ain't something I do for fun, but I'll kill someone if I'm getting paid to do it.
Well, I have no wish for you to kill anyone.
Then what do you want with me?
I have a proposition that I think will be mutually beneficial to us. A way to make some money.
How much money?
Don't you want to hear what I want you to do first?
If there's enough money in it, I don't care what it is. And if there isn't enough money, it don't matter what it is.
$3,000.
$3,000?
Yes.
That's my share, you mean. That's not the total amount.
No, the total amount is $15,812.50.
Wait a minute. The total amount is over $15,000, but I'm only going to get $3,000?
Isn't that enough? A moment ago, you seemed quite pleased with the $3,000.
Yeah, well, that was before I learned that the total amount was over $15,000. I want half.
But I have had to do all the planning. I'm the one who has set it up.
But you need me for some reason, right?
Yes, of course. I wouldn't have contacted you.
What do you need me for?
I shall need you to take the money from the gentleman in question.
In other words, you need someone to supply the muscle.
Yes.
Let me ask you this, Denman. What would keep me from just taking the money myself and leaving you out of it?
I would hope that you would have enough honor to hold up your end of the bargain.
Honor, huh? You mean as in honor among thieves, something like that?
Something like that, yes. And, of course, a realization that I can supply you with many more opportunities to make money.
But, and let me get this straight, I am to get only $3,000 and you'll get $12,000?
On this particular job, yes.
Well, I tell you what, $3,000 don't buy a lot of honor, but $8,000 does.
That's more than half.
Yeah, well, you said more than $15,000, and my math ain't all that good. If the total is over $15,000, then that's getting close to $16,000, and half of $16,000 is $8,000.
Yes, I believe that upon further reflection, I can see your point of view. Very well. Your share will be $8,000. And if this particular arrangement works out all right, I'm sure I'll be able to find other, let us say, opportunities for us to work together.
All right, let's hear it. What is this opportunity?
I don't know if Mr. Howard told you about me, but like Howard, I work in the Kansas City Cattle Exchange. We have recently closed a business deal with a rancher from Wyoming. He is coming to Kansas City to buy 500 head of cattle.
He's coming to buy cattle? I thought people came here to sell you cattle.
We both buy and sell. That's why we are called a cattle exchange. Anyway, I have been in contact with the gentleman in question, and I know that he will have on his person enough money in cash to make the purchase.
Why would he be bringing that much money with him in cash? I thought rich folks wrote bank drafts and the like.
Normally, that would be the case, but Mr. McAllister will be bringing cash because I made all the arrangements, and I told him that we will require cash on delivery.
Wait a minute. You mean he don't really need to be bringing cash? He's just carrying it because you told him to?
Yes.
Damn. It really is true what they say, ain't it? Some folks rob you with a gun, and some folks rob you with a fountain pen.
Before I go any further with this, are you willing to undertake this operation?
Yeah, I'm in. But I do have a question. How am I going to know who it is?
His name is McAllister. Duff McAllister.
Now, what does he look like?
Oh, I don't have any idea what he looks like.
Well, if you don't know what he looks like, just tell me how in hell I'm going to know who it is I'm supposed to rob.
He is coming here by train from Cheyenne, Wyoming. He will telegraph us before he leaves Cheyenne. Since he cannot come here directly from Cheyenne, he will have to change trains in Fremont, Nebraska. You will be in Fremont, and I will telegraph you with information as to what day he will arrive there. Now, the eastbound train from Cheyenne arrives in Fremont just before midnight, and the train from Fremont to here will not leave until 1:30 the following afternoon. Mr. McAllister is a wealthy man. So that means he will not spend all that time in the depot. Now, he will, no doubt, walk from the depot to the hotel. He will be alone, and it will be in the darkest part of the night. I think that if you get to Fremont before him, you will be able to find a place somewhere between the depot and the hotel where you might accost him and relieve him of his money.
You still ain't told me how I'm going to recognize him.
As I said, he will be carrying almost $16,000 in cash, and in order to carry that much money, he shall require a small satchel of some kind. That is how you will be able to recognize him.
So what you're saying is I'm supposed to go after everyone who gets off the train that's carrying one of them little satchels?
Well, if necessary, in order to find the right one. But how many men do you suppose will exit the train at that time of night carrying a briefcase and bound for the hotel?
All right, I guess you got a point there. Me and you have us a deal. Now, let me ask you something else.
Yes.
What about the whore?
I beg your pardon?
The whore, over there. Are you going to take her to bed or not?
Hey, heavens, no.
Well, then you don't have no problem with me taking her?
You can have her. I must go.
Even as Hodge, Denman, and Crack Kingsley were having their discussion, Duff was at Sky Meadow, getting ready for the big fireman's ball. While in Scotland, Duff had been a captain of the Black Watch Regiment. Because of that, he had a complete Black Watch uniform, which consisted of a Glengarry hat with the cap badge of the Black Watch, Saltier, the lion rampant in the crown with the motto, Nemo me impune lacessit, no one provokes me with impunity, a kilt of blue and green tartan, a black waistcoat, an embossed leather sporran which he wore round his waist, knee-high stockings, and the skean-do, or ceremonial knife, tucked into the right kilt stocking, with only the pommel visible. He was also wearing the Victoria Cross, Great Britain's highest award for bravery, which was awarded him for his bravery above and beyond the call of duty during the Battle of Tel el-Kebir in Egypt. At the moment, Duff was standing in front of the hall mirror, making certain that all was as it should be, when Elmer came in, having just returned from the post office in town.
You got that letter you was looking for from the Kansas City Cattle Exchange?
Good, let me see it.
Elmer handed Duff the letter, and he read it, then nodded.
Aye, this confirms the telegram. They want me to bring the money there in cash, and I'll have to make my own arrangements for the train.
I tell you what, Duff, once you get all set up there in Kansas City, you send me a telegram telling me what time you plan on being in Cheyenne, and I'll round up enough hands so we can push the herd back here.
All right, thank you.
Also, I got the buckboard all hooked up and ready to go. So you just let me know when... Damn. Pardon me, boss, for mentioning it, but that sure is some hell of an outfit you're wearing.
Tis my regimental uniform.
I say this for you. Takes a brave man to wear something like that here. But I reckon anyone who makes fun of it's gonna have to answer to you, huh?
There will be but few who would dare to make mockery of the blue and green.
Yeah, I reckon that's so. Oh, just so you know, Duff, I ain't making no mockery of it.
I didn't think you were.
Elmer was wearing a brown four-button suit coat, black and brown striped trousers, a rounded lapel burgundy silk vest, and a saloon keeper's tie that was a black neckband from which 4 3-inch strips of cloth were suspended.
I must say that you seem exceptionally well turned out yourself.
I bought this here suit from a mail-order catalog. Would you believe this is the first suit I ever owned?
Is it? No.
Now, I bet the first time you seen me, you never thought you'd see me in a suit like this. Now, did you?
Well, to tell the truth, Elmer, first time I saw you, I wasn't even sure you were human.
Yeah, well, I'm human enough now. And if you think all the widow women in town ain't gonna be happy to see me, well, you got yourself another thing coming.
All the widows, Elmer? Or would you be talking about one in particular? Mrs. Winslow, I believe?
Well, you gotta admit, Dove, Vi Winslow is a handsome enough woman.
Aye, she is at that. Come, Elmer. We don't want to keep the ladies waiting, do we?
Oh, no, sir, not at all. I just wouldn't be right for a couple of handsome galoots like us to keep the ladies waiting.
The dance was being held in the ballroom of the Dunn Hotel. The hotel was on the corner of Bowie Avenue and First Street, and the ladies of the town had spent the entire day decorating it for the dance. Red, white, and blue bunting hung from the walls, and potted plants and bouquet of flowers were in the corners and on the tables that were placed around the outer corners of the floor, thus allowing enough space for the dance. Megan arrived before Duff, and after seeing oohs and ahs from all the other women about her dress, she walked over to one side so she could keep an eye on the door without being too obvious. A few minutes later, Megan saw Duff standing just inside the front door. He was perusing the room. He was in his kilts. For most men, well, in fact, for just about any other man Megan knew, that would have been a farcical entry. But Duff towered over every other man there, not only in his height, but in his raw power, broad shoulders, powerful arms, and muscular legs, shown off by what he was wearing. Duff and Megan saw each other at about the same time, and with a big smile, Duff came toward her.
My, don't you look beautiful tonight?
So do you.
Oh, sure, and don't let Elmer hear you say that. Methinks he is having a bit of a problem with me wearing of the kilts as it is. And I suppose it is a bit pretentious of me.
Nonsense. You look devilishly handsome.
With that, Megan offered up her arm, and Duff happily took it and led her out to the dance floor. Elmer and Vi Winslow were sitting this dance out.
Don't they make a good-looking couple?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Handsome enough, I reckon. But if you was to ask me, well, I'd say we'd make a right handsome couple our own selves.
Hush, Elmer. You got me blushing like a young girl.
Oh, hell, Vi, you are a young girl. Pretty as one, anyhow. You make the best pies I ever had.
Elmer, now I don't know if it's me or my pies you're interested in.
Both.
Well, after the dance, you'll have to stop by the restaurant for a piece of pie.
Oh, say, that sounds like a good idea. We'll get Duff and Miss Parker, too.
No.
How come?
Oh, Megan and I discussed it. This'll give him a chance to be alone.
Oh?
And us, too.
After the dance, Duff walked Megan home, and she invited him up to her apartment.
Would you like a cup of coffee to help keep you awake for your drive back out to the ranch?
I'd like to, but Elmer and I came into town together, and he...
Worry not about Elmer. Vi will keep him busy for a while.
How do you know?
Would you believe me if I said we arranged it?
Who would have thought that women could be so devious?
Oh, devious? Not devious. Cooperative.
Cooperative.
Megan stepped over to the cooking stove that already had wood and kindling laid in. She lit the fire, which caught quickly, and within a few minutes her apartment was permeated by the rich aroma of coffee at the boil.
I got a letter from the Kansas City Cattle Exchange today, so I expect I'll be leaving Monday morning to go to Kansas City.
Will you write to me while you're gone?
Aye, if you think the scribbling of a Scotsman would be of interest.
Oh, I think it would be of great interest. And I also want you to do something else for me, if you would.
And what would that be?
Megan walked over to a cabinet and opened a drawer. Reaching in, she pulled out a piece of yellow ribbon.
I've sewn a lock of my hair into this ribbon, and I've added a few drops of my favorite perfume. It's foolish, I know, but if you would, I would like you to carry it with you.
Megan, I...
Worry not about any implied meaning. It's for luck, and for luck only. It will comfort me to know that you have it with you.
I wasn't about to protest. I was about to tell you that I'd be most happy to carry it with me. The French call this a jeton d'affection.
Oh, what lovely sounding words. What does that mean?
It means a token of affection.
Really?
Duff raised the ribbon to his nose, inhaled the perfume, then he kissed it.
You can be satisfied with kissing the ribbon, or...
Or?
This.
Megan stood on her tiptoes and lifted her lips to his to kiss him.
I hope you do not think ill of me for doing such a thing.
Megan Parker, I could never think ill of you. And I promise you that this...
Duff held up the yellow ribbon.
And your kiss will be with me for my whole journey.
Duff and Elmer had not ridden into town, but had driven a buckboard. They were talking animatedly about the events of the night as they drove back home. But about 2 miles from Sky Meadow, they saw an orange glow in the dark sky ahead.
What's that?
It looks like a fire at home.
Yeah!
As they got closer to the ranch, they could see flames in the sky. And closer still, they saw that the barn was on fire.
Sure, and what would make the barn catch fire? We left no lanterns or such.
By now, the barn was totally involved. The fire was leaping high into the air, and they could feel the heat. It was too late to do anything about the fire, or even to help the animals, the 2 milk cows in the sky. Fortunately, Elmer's horse, Rebel, was one of the 2 that were pulling the buckboard.
Sky.
Looking around, they saw Sky standing near the house, his eyes shining in the light of the fire.
Sky!
Sky lowered his head and let Duff pet him.
I thought I'd lost you.
Sky pulled away from Duff and trotted over to the fence. Then he turned back toward Duff.
What do you think he's found over there?
Elmer and Duff started toward Sky, but they saw, even before they got there, what Sky was trying to show him. There was the body of a man lying on the ground. The man's fingers were clutched around the handle of a kerosene can.
I be damned, this must be the son of a bitch who burned the barn. What's he doing here?
Look at the side of his head. I think Sky must have killed him.
Well, good for you, Sky.
Elmer leaned down for a closer look.
Wait a damn minute. I know this galoot.
You do? Who is it?
Name is Cleed Wilson. You heard the story they told about the fella that braced me in Fiddler's Green?
Aye.
Yeah, well, this is him. He must have found out that I lived out here and figured burning your barn would get even with me. Damn, I'm sorry, Duff. Looks like I brought this one on you.
Nothing for you to be sorry about. You had nothing to do with it.
What you want me to do with him?
Take him into town tomorrow, I suppose. Take him to Constable Farrell's office. I expect he'll know what to do next.
Because Duff got away from Sky Meadow late, he didn't reach Cheyenne until it was already past normal business hours. After taking care of his horse, Duff walked to the Interocean Hotel to check in. He decided to have dinner in the Cheyenne Club, believing it to be more secure than a restaurant. He ordered a steak and baked potato and was just finishing his meal when Warren and Converse, both cattlemen themselves, came in, already in the midst of some conversation. Seeing him, they walked over to his table.
Hello, Duff. Do you mind if we join you?
Not at all.
What are you doing back in Cheyenne so soon?
I'm taking the train to Kansas City to pick up my cattle.
You mean they won't ship them to you?
In the letter, they said no.
That doesn't sound like they want your business all that much. In fact, doesn't sound like the KCCE at all. I bought my first Herefords from them, and they shipped them right to me. Made all the arrangements themselves.
Well, you forget, Francis. Duff is getting Black Angus. Maybe they're afraid some buffalo will get into the herd and take care of the bull's business. Say, Duff, you haven't run into a fella by the name of Gilbert Patton since you got into town, have you?
No, I can't say as I have. Who is he?
He's a man that wants to do for you what Colonel Prentice Ingram has done for your cousin, Falcon. He wants to write about you in one of his novels and make you famous.
He's read about your exploits, the events up in Chaguata last year, the more recent shows here, and on the road back to Chaguata.
He's here in the club right now. We can introduce you to him if you would like.
No, thank you. I'd rather not meet him.
What did I tell you? You owe me $50.
Yeah, you were right. Don't rub it in.
Converse removed five $10 bills and counted them out into Warren's hand.
In case you're wondering what this is about, I bet Converse that you wouldn't want anything to do with Patton.
And I was sure you would.
What made you think such a thing?
Why, everyone would like to be famous, wouldn't they?
I don't know about everyone else, but as for me, I will pass on that cup, thank you.
Then if you really don't want to meet him, you'd best leave by the back door. He's sitting out front in the lobby right now, and sure as a gun is iron. If you walk through there, someone is going to point you out to him.
Thanks.
Later, Duff stood at the window of his room on the third floor of the Interocean Hotel, looking out at the traffic, both foot and carriage, on 16th and Capitol below. There was no greater demonstration of the difference between Cheyenne and Chugwater than this, for by this time of evening in Chugwater, the streets and sidewalks were totally empty, with the restaurant and Fiddler's Green showing the only signs of life. Here, though it was past 8 o'clock already, the streets were teeming. Duff held up the little piece of yellow ribbon Megan had given him, and as he let the hair brush against the tip of his nose and he inhaled the perfume, he thought of her. Could Megan take the place of Sky McGregor?
No. Nobody can ever take Sky's place.
But could Megan find her own place in Duff's heart, a place that was at least equal to Sky's? It was too early for Duff to make that appraisal, but he was already willing to admit that the idea was not beyond possibility. Then, even as he considered it, he thought of what happened to Sky. He had been the one they were shooting at, not Sky, but Sky was the one they had killed. And, already here, he had shown a proclivity for finding himself in dangerous situations. He'd been attacked on the trail going back home last week. If Megan had been with him, she could have been killed. Then there was the burning of his barn last night. Yeah, Elmer said they were after him, but it didn't matter. He had lost 2 cows in the fire, and it could just as easily have been his house that was burned. If Megan had been in his house, she could have been killed. If another young woman died just because she loved him and he loved her, he didn't know if he could live with it.
Am I really willing to take that chance with Megan?
Turning, he put the ribbon away, then turned off the lamp and crawled into bed. Before going to sleep, he thought about the trip tomorrow and the arrangements he would have to make to bring his cattle back home. And at 25 cows per car, he would have to lease 20 cars, but he had already been in contact with both railroads and was assured that it would not be difficult to make such arrangements.
I wonder, would Megan even want to give up her dress shop and come out to the ranch to live? Och, am I premature in even thinking such a thing? Truth, I have no idea what Megan really thinks of me.
Fremont, Nebraska. When Crack Kingsley arrived in Fremont, he told people that his name was Carl Butler, that he worked for the Kansas City Cattle Exchange, and was there to check out the local ranchers and farmers to ascertain for his employer whether or not they had any cattle for sale. He let it be known that he'd be hanging out in the OK Saloon and would be willing to talk to any rancher or farmer who cared to come see him. He was interviewing now.
So, let me get this straight.
A man named Lloyd Evans was speaking to him.
The Kansas City Cattle Exchange will buy every one of my cows, pay top dollar for them, and all I gotta do is drive them in here to the railroad? They do the shipping?
That's right.
Well, hell yes, I'd be willing to do that. What you're saying is I'll be saving money on the shipping cost. Sign me up.
No, don't be so quick. All I'm doing now is what is called making a survey. The company wants to see if there'll be enough people interested to actually make it worthwhile.
Well, you can definitely sign me up for being interested. I don't know how anybody wouldn't be.
Good. I'll put your name down.
Where?
What?
Where are you going to put my name down? You ain't got no book nor paper nor nothing like that with you.
I meant before I leave to go back to Kansas City.
In the last 2 days, Kingsley had interviewed 4 farmers and 2 ranchers, promising all of them that the Kansas City Cattle Exchange would not only buy their stock at top dollar per head, but would also arrange and pay for all shipping. While he was waiting for the train on which his target would be riding to arrive, he decided that it might be good to have someone with him, just as a bit of insurance. During his 2 days, he'd watched the saloon customers as they came and went. On the evening of his first day in Fremont, he had also witnessed an exchange between the deputy town marshal and a man named Clem Crocker. Though the incident had not led to violence, Crocker had made it perfectly clear that he was not completely in favor of the law. Kingsley had done nothing then, but this afternoon, seeing Crocker sitting at a table alone, he took a bottle of whiskey and his glass over to Crocker's table and sat down to join him. He refilled Crocker's glass.
What's this for? You're wasting your time with me, Mr. Butler. I ain't got no cows to sell.
That's all right. My name's not Butler. It's Kingsley. Crack Kingsley. And I'm not here to buy any cows.
What do you mean? Ain't that what you've been doing here these past 2 days? Talking to folks about buying their hogs and cows?
Yeah, that's what I've been doing, but only because that's what I'm wanting folks to think.
Well, then what are you doing?
I'm getting set to make some money. You can too, if you're interested.
What do I have to do?
Nothing you ain't never done before, if the deputy was right yesterday.
I didn't break into Thrower's store the other night.
Not the other night, but you did do it before, didn't you?
Yeah, but I done served 6 months in jail for that.
How much money did you get?
$12.
Was it worth serving 6 months for $12?
Hell no. I've learned my lesson.
Have you now? Tell me, Crocker, what lesson have you learned? Not to steal again? Or just not to steal such a small amount of money?
What are you getting at?
Suppose you was to get $100.
Ain't no store in town keeps that much money overnight, except the bank. And I ain't about to try and hold up the bank. Hell, I couldn't get away with it anyway. Everyone in town knows me.
The job I'm talking about has nothing to do with a local store, or anyone local for that matter. And you won't have to be breaking in. In fact, the only thing you're going to have to do is spot my target and be my lookout.
And how am I supposed to spot your target if it ain't someone local? Like as not, I won't have no idea who it is.
I'll tell you how to spot him.
And I'll get $100 for that. Just for spotting the man you're going to rob and being the lookout for you.
Yeah.
All right. You got yourself a deal.
The Union Pacific Depot in Cheyenne was located at the south end of Capitol Street, just catty-corner from the Interocean Hotel. The depot was the biggest building in town, two stories high and a block long. It also had a tower in the middle, which was the highest structure in the city, and from which many photographs of the town had been taken. The inside of the depot seemed much larger than one would suppose a town the size of Cheyenne would be able to support. It rivaled depots in the much larger cities of Denver, St. Louis, and Chicago. But such was the confidence in the growth of the town that Union Pacific had spared no expense in the building. Its defenders pointed out, though, that the large depot was justified by the fact that Cheyenne was an important stop for passengers who were traveling through from coast to coast. As many passengers came through Cheyenne in 1 week as there were citizens in the entire town. Just inside the depot, there was a big chalkboard with the schedules of east and westbound trains. One column had the name of the train, the next, whether it was west or eastbound, the next, the time it was due, and the final column was labeled Latest Telegraphic Intelligence on Train Schedule. Next to the blackboard with the train schedules was another, smaller one, with information on stage coaches. The train Duff would be taken was the Western Glory. And according to the latest telegraphic intelligence on train schedule, it was on time. With his tickets in one hand and his briefcase in the other, Duff took a seat on a bench. He didn't have to wait long for the train to arrive. The train came to a halt and the conductor stepped down from one of the cars and stood there as the arriving passengers disembarked. In the year Duff had been in America, he'd gone twice by train back to New York. He'd learned from such trips that the composition of the passengers was different, depending on which way you were going. Most of the westbound passengers were embarking upon new adventures, and they were high of spirits, eager with anticipation to see what their new lives would present. The passengers going east consisted of two groups, those who had succeeded in their ventures and were now going back in triumph, and the much larger group who were returning dispirited and frustrated by their lack of success. When all the arriving passengers had disembarked, the conductor looked at his watch importantly.
All aboard!
Duff waited as all the other passengers stepped aboard, then he boarded as well. Soon, he would be on his way. Crack Kingsley sat in the OK Saloon, waiting for Clem Crocker. As he had every day since he arrived in town, Crack had gone to the Western Union office to see if there was a telegram for Carl Butler. today, it had arrived.
Baby boy born this morning. Mother is doing well.
That was the agreed-upon code, and it meant the McAllister would be coming through Fremont tonight. At that moment, Crocker came in and approached his table.
Well, it's tonight. All right. Now let me get this straight. All I have to do is spot him, then come back and tell you, right? That's all you have to do. And I get $100 for it. You'll get $100 for it. Meet me back here tonight at 11 o'clock.
Duff's train had arrived a few minutes before midnight. He was tired, but glad to be off the train. He stood by as the baggage was taken off the train and loaded onto a large push cart. He saw his suitcase and saw that it was transferred over to another cart marked Missouri Pacific. Clem Crocker was watching him the entire time. He had been told to look for a man carrying a small satchel, and he had seen the man getting off the train carrying one. The satchel really didn't matter, though. Only two men had stepped down from the train. One was a preacher, so this one had to be him. As the man made arrangements for his luggage, Crocker hurried on up South Union Street to Dodge Street. The hotel was on Dodge between Clarkson and Irving, and Kingsley was waiting there in the space between Watkins Mercantile and Freeman's Hardware Store. At least he was supposed to be waiting there, but when Crocker got there, he didn't see him.
Kingsley! Kingsley, you here?
Shut up, you fool!
Kingsley was in the dark shadows between the two buildings.
Don't be shouting my name out like that.
Oh, I see him. He'll be coming along in a few minutes.
Is he carrying a satchel?
Yep, just like you said.
Go across the street and wait. When you see him coming, step back in between them buildings so he can't see you. Then light a match. Whenever I see the match, I'll know he's near here.
What are you gonna do?
What difference does it make to you as long as you get your $100?
Right. Don't make no difference to me at all.
Crocker hurried back across the street, stepped in between White's drugstore and Wong's laundry, then looked back toward Union. He had to urinate, and it was dark here, so he did. He was just finishing up when he saw the man he was looking for turn off Union onto Dodge, then pass under the street lamp.
Damn. I'm glad I seen him. If I'd have missed him while I was taking a leak, that would have been one expensive pee.
Crocker moved back toward the street and watched until the man with the satchel got closer. Then, when he thought he was close enough, he stepped farther back in between the two buildings and lit a match. Kingsley saw the flare of the match, then stepped up to the corner of the building and pulled his gun from its holster. Turning it around, he grabbed the barrel of his pistol. He waited until Duff was just about there. Then he raised his pistol, and as McAllister passed by, he brought the butt of the pistol down on his head. Quickly, Kingsley grabbed the briefcase and opened it, just as Crocker came running across the street.
Did you kill him?
Quiet, damn it! I don't know.
Kingsley pulled out a little packet of bills, then closed the attaché case. He counted off 5 20s.
Oh, how much money is there?
What does it matter to you? I promised you $100. Here it is. And all you had to do was tell me when he was coming.
Hell yeah, I guess you're right.
Ain't no guessing to it. Here, take your money.
The briefcase firmly in his grasp, Kingsley hurried on down Dodge Street. Crocker watched him until he disappeared in the darkness.
Damn, I better get out of here my own self.
Just as Crocker started to leave, he saw a piece of yellow ribbon lying on the sidewalk some feet away from the man Kingsley had hit. Thinking it may have been dropped as someone was leaving Schoenberg's Mercantile, he walked over to pick it up. When he did, and noticed that it had a lock of hair attached to it. He could also smell perfume on it.
Well now, looky here. Wonder what woman dropped this.